Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. NBA All-Star Weekend begins today. Expect a lot of people, road closures, luminaries, and of course, the game. We'll fill you in. The city council reverses course and says no to four-year terms. An ICE roundup coupled with CMPD DWI checkpoints have some members of the community on edge. BB&T and SunTrust decide to merge and to make Charlotte home. A new sales tax for the arts is being talked about. And we get another airline. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others. And those reporters include Alex Olgan from WFAE News. She's on my left. Good morning.
Good morning. Morning.
Gwendolyn Glenn directly in front of me. She's also from WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner on my right is here from WBTV News.
Hello.
You're on my. You're literally on my side right now. And Eric Spanberg is back. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
You can listen to us. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. But you can also watch us on Facebook Live from our main studio today because we thought, with the NBA being in town, we might not be able to get to our Spirit Square studio. Probably not the case. But let's not talk about that yet. Let's talk about four-year terms. Charlotte City Council has been talking about this on and off now for months, wrangling over whether to make a decision themselves or to send the decision to a referendum in November. And on Monday night, even though most members want four-year terms, they decided no. Was that a surprise? A, was it a surprise that they decided no? Was it a surprise that they decided anything at all?
It was a surprise to me that they decided no, because this has really moved on a fast track for much of the past 6 months. The previous week when they discussed this, it looked like they were full steam ahead for having this on the ballot in November, and it really didn't seem to be very controversial, at least on the council. Now, I think what happened was that the mayor and some others got to council members and reminded them of the history of four-year terms in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. Remember, it was only 2015 when I think two-thirds of the voters shot down the idea of four-year terms for Mecklenburg County commissioners. So this was going to be a difficult ask, as they would say.
You're the only person who's been here long enough to comment on this, I think. But what is the voting public's reluctance to have council serve 4 year term? What do you think?
I think it's just one of those things. It's always been 2 years, and people are, of course, inherently skeptical of political motive, and they're just used to it being done this way, and they don't see any reason to go to four-year terms.
And there is no real reason. What is the value in four-year terms? And I was also shocked that they voted it down. I thought it would pass handily. And I think the bigger surprise to me was the margin by which it was defeated. What is, I think, three council members who
seven
voted?
To three.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's it, for a thing that most of the council seemed to want.
Yeah.
And then also, I think maybe this is the first kind of defeat of this new generation of millennial council members who largely was a new council with new ideas. This is a thing you might have. Hey, let's talk about an idea that's been used before.
Well, and remember the first meeting, Braxton Winston said, we need higher pay and we need longer terms. And that obviously miffed some people, but others on the council certainly were agreeable to that idea. And it did look like it had a lot of momentum, and then it fell apart.
So the two Republicans on council, Tariq Bakari and Ed Driggs, said no. There are four Democrats said no. Justin Harlow, Greg Phipps, Dimple Ajmera, and Matt Newton. And Harlow agreed with the mayor, saying that the council, that the voters, rather, would likely say no if it went to a referendum.
I know there's some, you know, sentiment on this dais that there's somewhere under a rock overwhelming support for four-year terms for this council. But to kind of set ourselves up, understanding that, hey, this thing is going to get shot down on a ballot in November is just, I think it's just a waste of time.
The benefit of four-year terms, if you ask the mayor and others who are in favor of this, is that you don't have to run for office enough quite as often, and you can spend more time concentrating on the business at hand and learn where the bathrooms are, in other words, before you have to run for re-election again. Asheville, Cary, Durham, Greensboro, Winston-Salem all have four-year terms for council. Are we behind the curve, or is it just a thing? a Charlotte thing to have.
I think it's just kind of a Charlotte thing. This is something that has gone on for decades in terms of whether there should be 2 or 4 year terms. I always find it interesting, and it happened again this time, when politicians come out and say blatantly or bluntly, yeah, I mean, we only have 15 months because we got to spend the rest of the time campaigning, and we can't, we can't chew gum and walk at the same time. So,
but I don't think that's if by campaigning you mean we have to be visible in the community, right? We have to go knock on doors. It's not like they have to raise a ton of money, although increasingly more, but it's not like they have to raise a ton of money. And look, if members of Congress can do it from Washington, D.C., you can do it here in Charlotte. Yes, really no excuse.
And look what we have there.
Well, I'm not saying they're anything to emulate. I'm just, you know.
And they also say campaigning does take a lot of time, and there's a learning curve, and they can spend more time, as Mike said, diving into the issues as opposed to thinking about, right, I got to run for re-election.
I mean, think about it. They took office a year ago, this council, a year ago, and now they have to start running now because the primaries are coming up.
Well, and I think the other thing is, it is a stark admission that, hey, I'm not going to make any tough calls during the last 9 months of my term because I'm worried about being reelected.
Like raising taxes or anything. So, maybe that's, people might like that.
So this issue's not over yet because Mayor Lyles was on this program yesterday, and she said that this actually should be considered following the 2020 census, which is also coming up, because that's the time when council districts are likely to be redrawn. The last time this came up was in, 2011,
they had a study committee that recommended against.
So 2020 is a year away. Stay tuned for more on this topic. It'll be coming up next year.
Hey, is this an operation with ICE and the U.S. Marshals? What type of operation is this? You can't tell me?
The sound of a Facebook live feed from Comunidad Colectiva. It's a local immigrant rights group. They followed ICE agents to document their activities as they fanned out across North Carolina, making 200 arrests this week, including at least a dozen in Charlotte. Are these roundups unusual? Are they something new on the part of ICE, something that's increasing in frequency?
I mean, there have always been work raids, especially when Obama was president. But it sounds to me like, I mean, I don't know for sure if it's retaliation, but they said this is the new normal, and they partly blamed the sheriffs not working with ICE as well. So I wonder if it's some sort of...
Well, and obviously the leader of the regional office has said point blank that they're going to do more of this because of the policies of the sheriffs in Wake and Mecklenburg counties, among others. So
it's five sheriffs. This really stems from 287G, which is a program that allowed sheriffs to have access to ICE data. So when every person who is booked into that county's jail, you run their immigration status. And then that allows sheriff's deputies to effectively become ICE agents as well.
Right.
And they refer them to ICE. And so in the 2018 election, there was a coordinated effort from national outside groups to challenge five sheriffs in North Carolina who were still using 287G. It's been controversial for 10 years since its inception. Was kind of pushed by Elizabeth Dole, who was then a senator from North Carolina when it started. And so Gary McFadden swept into office as one of those five, Wake County, Guilford County, I think Forsyth County, maybe Durham, was the fifth one. And so as a result, ICE was very clear in saying, because we're not going to have this enforcement mechanism at our jails, we're going to have to do more enforcement in the community.
Yeah. So Sean Gallagher, the director of the ICE office overseeing the Carolinas, said that these operations are now, in fact, the new normal.
This is a direct correlation between the sheriff's dangerous policies of not cooperating with ICE and the fact that we have to still continue to execute our important law enforcement mission.
So the five sheriffs that you referenced, plus CMPD Chief Kirk Putney, have said that they don't like 287G because they think it makes the community less safe because it has a negative impact on immigrant communities. They're afraid to come forward, even to call for things that they actually need the police to come into. Whereas ICE says it's a public safety issue because of these people come in and they're here illegally, et cetera, et cetera. How odd is it to have law enforcement agencies at odds with each other on the same topic?
I think they just have different priorities, right? Because the federal government, the ICE agents think their priority in what they consider public safety is immigrants, you know, illegally in the U.S. or committing crimes in the U.S., whereas the community police, the sheriffs and the police, they want safety from local crimes. You know, they're not look, they don't care so much about whether the person that's committing the crime is an immigrant or not.
And here's the other interesting point on cooperation with ICE. The sheriff's office, was it earlier this week, maybe late last week, put out a press release where they ticked through all of the other things that they still do to cooperate with ICE, including if there's a valid ICE detainer on someone already, they'll hold that prisoner and turn him over to ICE. I mean, among other things, and it was notable to me because the sheriff's office was going out of its way to say, look, here are all the other things we do other than this one program.
When the sheriffs were turning the names of people they have arrested over or they have detained and put in jail over to ICE, are you getting a different population than if you just go out and have these raids? And you're picking up people who have not committed crimes?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course you are, yes, because there are people who have done something wrong, obviously, and then they're running. Or they've allegedly done something wrong, but there's a reason for them being detained. It's not simply, I saw you out in the community and I suspect randomly.
Or you're dropping your kid off at school,
right?
And so we have an opportunity to
meet
that, you. Yeah.
In that 200 number, I think it was something like 60 were not targeted. They just happened to be there when they were arresting other folk who were here illegally.
Is this an example of the divide in the country? Because we have mostly the sheriffs that are not cooperating with 287G are in democratically controlled areas of the state, and ICE obviously is under this mandate from the Trump administration because he wants undocumented immigrants out of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think partisanship does play. It's not the entire story, but it's a big part of the story, I think, absolutely.
And especially for these five. Right?
Yes, especially for these five.
And these ICE roundups became a subject of conversation at Monday's city council meeting because they happened to coincide with DWI traffic stops by CMPD along Central Avenue and Lansdale Drive. They had 25 officers stopping cars for speeding and for missing headlights and possible drunk drivers. And earlier in the day, ICE had conducted these raids. And some city council members, including Braxton Winston, questioned whether CMPD should have called off their checkpoints.
I understand our CMPD might have been using it to try to make our community safer. But it's something that continues to erode the trust within our immigrant communities that are highly concentrated right in that area.
Were these two law enforcement routines coordinated in any way?
It doesn't seem like it. I mean, I don't think we would know for sure, but it doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, the gentleman from the police department said that this was as a result of, was it a hit and run? I can't remember. There was something that had happened, and then they were going to try.
Related to DUI crime.
DUI. There was something related to DUI. That's why they were doing it. It didn't sound like it had anything to do with ICE, but I think the point that Councilman Winston was making is, yet again, this issue of will members of the immigrant community report to the police things that are going on because they're fearful of being detained themselves.
And in fact, Republican Councilman Ed Driggs was critical of some other council members trying to connect these two agencies' efforts and of what he called Winston's dark insinuation by Winston about CMPD checkpoint operations.
Creating these high-intensity things is part of the general responsibility of keeping roads safe. And I think the idea that there was some sort of collusion with anybody else is just disrespectful to our police department.
That's Councilman Ed Driggs. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the intersection of undocumented immigrants and city council, because something else came up at council this week that involved them or could possibly involve them going forward. We'll also talk about Luana Mayfield and her resignation from another board at the state level. And, of course, the NBA All-Star Weekend. Perhaps you've heard.
I understand. There might be some basketball players
in town. Yes, they're in town. About 150,000 of them. We're coming right back. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins, we're here with Alex Olgan and Gwendolyn Glenn, both from WFAE News. Nick Oxner's here from WBTV, and Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, is also here, but he's always here. He has a cot in the back room.
Bad penny.
Yeah. Earlier on Monday evening at the city council meeting, council voted to allow unregistered voters to serve on city boards and commissions. I think there are about 35 of these boards and commissions. Previously, you had to be a registered voter to serve, and some feel that this opens the door to non-citizens. Read that, undocumented immigrants. Why could that really happen?
I don't know the rules. Do you?
Well, you have to be a resident, right?
Right, yeah. So, yes, it could happen.
They wouldn't ask? They wouldn't feel the need to ask?
This is my assumption. I don't know the particulars of the rules. So if someone wants to correct me,
if undocumented immigrants are afraid to go to work, and some of them say they are now, and they're afraid to take their kids to school, and they say they are now,
what are the chances they're going to sign up to serve on a board? Yeah, I mean it feels like kind of a silly argument.
But it depends on what the boards and commissions are doing. Maybe they find valuable opinions from some of those people. And then, they need that side of things, so maybe it could be valuable.
Because even the mayor said yesterday on this program that they're going to have some meetings with people in the immigrant community. And I said, are they going to talk about the stresses of undocumented immigrants? Are they going to come out? We're going to find them. We're going to go to them. And I wonder if that will work, because if people are afraid of people in official positions, they're likely not to come forward.
Yeah. And that's what I meant. But when I said silly argument, I mean it seems very unlikely to me that all of a sudden you have commissions that are dominated by people who are illegal immigrants, since we have these other issues with not even, in some cases being able to get them to work with the police because of the fears of what's going on.
Perhaps the bigger concern here is the one that Tariq Bakari voiced in an editorial, a guest editorial in The Observer yesterday. It was headlined, City Council Puts Showmanship Over the Good of Charlotte. I don't believe he wrote the headline, but the article was about his vote, to allow unregistered voters to serve. And his argument is that we're pushing the envelope, perhaps trying the patience of state legislators, because his point is that they overruled Charlotte once before with HB2, and we seem to be on that path with this decision, because this is a Republican-Democrat divide, and guess what? The legislator is still Republican. Is he right about that? Could there be pushback from the legislature on this?
Over what? I mean, HB2 is a very specific...
Over allowing non-registered voters to serve on public boards.
But that is clearly in the purview of the city council, whereas,
this is a Dillon rule state. Let me remind you.
I always like it when we get to the Dillon rule portion of our discussion. Go ahead, Nick.
Just ask any of those conservative, seemingly or self-proclaimed conservatives, will tell you that they can do whatever they want with local government.
That's right.
That being said, it is different than the bathroom debate, because that impacted public areas. This impacts the operations of the city. I mean, quite frankly, I think that Vi Lyles herself and the city council, maybe as a whole, has a much better relationship with the General Assembly than it did under Jennifer Roberts.
Right.
I mean, Jennifer Roberts.
No question. No question about that one.
And so, there's not the animosity from the General Assembly to Charlotte that there was 2 years ago.
Okay. Meanwhile, CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox says families affected by ICE need support, and he is urging employees to help. Gwendolyn, he says students are stressed, anguished, and sleep deprived by this recent wave of raids. How many children are we talking about? I know we have a lot of ESL students in CMS.
Yeah, and I tried to get some additional information from them regarding the superintendent's comments and his concerns, and they were pretty vague about what exactly they wanted to do. And he said that he would provide additional resources to principals. And when I tried to say, well, what additional resources?
Yeah.
I was told that some kind of training and counseling support, and staff would get some more training, but there were no specifics. What kind of training? When would it be implemented? Would it be new training because they already have some kinds of training going on? Is this going to be some additional that you're doing?
Yeah.
But it was they were pretty vague about
was
that.
Was this week's, this last week's raid, was that the what precipitated this comment?
I'm sure it did because he made the comments during the school board meeting this
week. This moment
week.
Brought to you by iPhone. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, he made the comments shortly after all of that happened. So I'm sure it was that was why he focused on that, because you have a lot of concern with whether or not parents and are going to be, you know, arrested, and then students are, they've talked about that before, so it's not totally new.
And yeah, I mean, I've heard anecdotally from teachers that are friends, they say, well, when a kid comes to class and says, my parent got taken by, you know, deportation police to Mexico, that's a very scary thing. How do you respond to that as a teacher?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I've talked to teachers at some other schools as well, where you have large populations of Latino students and students from other countries, and they say, yeah, that is a concern, that students will come to them, social workers say, they will come to them and say, oh, may not necessarily be their parents, but a relative or a close neighbor was just arrested last night, so I can't concentrate.
Wilcox says that CMS does not and will not ask for a student's or family's immigration status at any point in the enrollment or registration process. He says residency status is not a factor in our enrollment to our schools. Wow.
Yeah, I think that all of this, going back to, you know, when Nick was talking to, and you were talking about the state, this just shows this is such a local problem. It's not a local state government fight, at least not yet. I don't think it's going to be. But boy, you talk about complicated.
Yeah.
The school system, the police department, city council, the county commission. I mean, it just goes on and on. There's so many threads to this story.
Well, he also added that student information is protected by both federal and state law and will not be shared. Does that mean he can stop ICE from coming in and going through school records?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. That'd be a further violation.
Yeah. Okay. And they're not supposed to be at bus stops trying to pick people up. So that I'm sure that's something.
Have they done that?
I don't know of any instances. There were probably last year there was a case. I think they were close to a bus stop, but it was not at a bus stop.
But the other reports, right? Part of the concern was that they were in unmarked cars and they weren't in uniform, right? With what the roundups in Charlotte, so not in schools, but in other aspects.
Sticking with CMS for just a second, they're changing their student wellness policy, which has not been updated since 2016, which was only two and a half years ago. But it has.
No, it's
some...
2006.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have the wrong date here. I'm sorry. Yes. Excuse me. It has some interesting elements, like having students screened for behavior issues early on before those behaviors escalate to the point of acting out. And you report, Gwendolyn, this is linked to student safety and violence in schools. Students up to 30 schools will answer a series of questions. Who chose the 30 schools?
I don't think they've chosen the 30 at this point.
Why only 30?
Well, it's a pilot program.
Okay.
It's a pilot program. So they're going to see how it works. And the wellness policy that would include this, it has not been voted on, but they are going to run this pilot program where with the 30 schools, they're going to ask them a series of questions. And they're dealing with emotional and social issues, how well adjusted the students are. So they have five different areas and they'll have a set of questions in each area. So the students will answer these questions themselves, and from that they'll compile it to see how do students feel about themselves, their confidence, how well adjusted. They'll pick up various things from this, mm-hmm. and the compiled data will be available to administrators, to counselors, social workers, and then they can see if there is something in there that might need additional support for these students, and also how teachers, they will have access to it, can work with them in the classroom. Now, it's not psychological testing. It's not testing for anxiety, depression. They want it to be very clear about that they are not doing that kind of test.
So what is it? If it's not, it still sounds psychological to me.
They say it's not. Say it's, okay. It's things like, you know, how well do you get along with other students, your social adjustment, your and I guess it is kind of related because they could pick up on some of that, but that's not what they're testing for.
Okay. Last week, Governor Roy Cooper canceled Charlotte City Councilwoman Luana Mayfield's appointment to the State Human Relations Commission because of a tweet she sent out and some Republican complaints about that tweet. And that tweet is about a year or so old now. But this week, she resigned from another commission, the Commission on Inclusion. Why? Anybody know?
I don't know that it's very clear, you know, other than that it comes a week after the other one was rescinded.
What is clear is her social media posts in the past have gotten her in other kinds of trouble.
Yeah, yes.
Well, yeah, the tweet that got her in trouble and got her knocked off the other commission was, it said that being black in the United States under President Trump has created homegrown terrorists wearing blue uniforms. And we had her on the program to talk about that. She sticks by that.
There was also the tweet that raised some controversy regarding the veracity of the 9/11 attacks, and mm-hmm. she did apologize for that tweet. But you're right, she did not apologize for the comments about relations between police departments and minorities. And obviously that led to her being knocked off this first commission, and then, I don't know, did she get frustrated and just say, I don't want to continue my work with the other one? She hasn't really said clearly why she left.
Okay.
No, but it is interesting that this is a rare time where the Republican General Assembly says, hey, Governor, you should do a thing or not do a thing, and that actually happened.
Hmm. So she's on the city council as well. She's still there. Meanwhile, Longleaf Politics is reporting that the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office is alleging that Charlotte City Councilman Braxton Winston appears to be attempting to avoid deputies seeking to serve him with legal papers.
Well, that's not just from that one obscure website. That was from a press release that was sent out yesterday by the sheriff's office.
Okay.
That alleged or that documented the 7 times the sheriff's office has attempted to serve.
How difficult is it to serve a city council person who you know where he is every Monday night?
What I wondered. I mean, it's not a mystery. On Monday night, he's usually in the government center.
So according to the press release from the sheriff's office, they tried to serve Councilman Winston at the government center at Monday city council meeting. And according to the press release, the deputy, they were, I think, waiting for him down near his vehicle or something like that. And they told CMPD that what they were there to do. Somehow Winston got wind of it and went out a different exit.
The Mark Harris exit.
Well, no, because the fire alarm didn't go off.
That's right. So this, I believe that this centers around a decision of he and his wife to divorce. So should this really be public just because he's a public figure?
Well, I mean, I think that question is so long ago dispatched. It doesn't really matter whether it should be. It almost always is when you're talking about people who are in political office. So.
But it begs the question of what was the motivation of the sheriff's office to put this press release? I mean, clearly someone was frustrated by the inability to serve Braxton Winston. That's why it was a story on our air last night.
And he posted on Twitter essentially saying, call my lawyer if you have questions, but this is a family private.
And he said that he would accept service within the next 24 hours. So.
Well, we're talking about all this because, as everybody knows, it's All-Star Week, and we want our visitors to know all of our dirty laundry here. The last time the NBA All-Star Game was in Charlotte was in 1991, and this weekend it returns.
I was here in 1991 when the game was here and played at Tavola. Quite naturally, the fan support was unbelievable. Had a decent game, didn't win MVP, but we look forward to bringing that same type of energy back.
Tavola. Live here much? Really? Tavola. That's Michael Jordan, that's his first appearance on this program, because he's elusive.
Welcome to Charlotte Talks,
that's
Mike.
That's right. He played here in 1991.
Smell a squawk skit coming up.
Yes.
He's now hosting the game as owner of the Hornets, and that just shows you how much has changed since the last time the game was played here. I know a lot of people came to town back then, but this year's event is rumored to be the largest in Charlotte history, largest sporting event in Charlotte history, with 150,000 people expected to come, bringing $100 million into the economy. You hosted this program's NBA All-Star Week preview, Eric, earlier this week on Wednesday. What does this game, this weekend, mean to the city?
Well, of course, it depends who you ask. Those big numbers are from the boosters and the organizers. I mean, it's certainly a big deal. If you go downtown, you can tell there's a lot going on, and it certainly comes at a good time of year. I think the biggest thing with these kind of events is, you know, trying to make a good impression, hopefully people are watching on TV, the city looks good, that kind of thing. I mean, it's very intangible. It's hard to quantify. And so I think that's why it frustrates people who are critical of, you know, spending government money on security or traffic or whatever it is. But certainly this is going to be one of the larger events in Charlotte since the 2012 Democratic National Convention.
It also means a lot of road closures. It means changes in public transit today through the weekend. It means scooters and bicycle use have been curtailed around the Spectrum Arena. Some schools, I think five schools, are closing at 12:15 today.
Students are very sad about that.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. Mayor Lyles was on the program yesterday, and she said that this is a dress rehearsal for the Republican National Convention in 2020. Are all these security precautions, all these road closures, the fact that people will have to get off the blue line at stops on either side of this, the Spectrum Center, so that they can sweep the train and then they can get back on, and they've closed the stop at the Spectrum Center, which seems to be
counterintuitive?
Well, yeah. Is all this because of Charlotte, because of the convention coming here in 2020, because of Homeland Security wanting to see how this all works? Why are we doing all
this?
Well,
I think this is this goes with any high-profile sporting event at this point. It doesn't matter where you are. Super Bowl.
I asked the mayor this yesterday, and you're a sports guy. Mm-hmm. So would this happen at Madison Square Garden? There's a subway stop that runs through it. Would they be closing the Port Authority?
I doubt it.
I don't think they would close the subway stop. But, I mean, our transit system's a little different.
I don't think that many people rely on it.
It's just smaller.
You would think it would be less of a threat. I don't know. That you can only have clear bags on the blue line now. That's been announced.
But that's, you know, when you go into Bank of America Stadium. I mean,
not the transit system.
Once you get off, and then if you don't have a clear bag, then you can't get back on. But I've talked to some people who say that they feel comfortable with it, that they don't have an issue with it, even with the rail, and because they said, you know, you never know, this is going to be a large crowd with things that are happening around the country with bombs and that kind of thing.
This is the post 9/11 world. I mean,
they feel comfortable.
And the sports leagues demand that they have everything locked down tightly.
So you had Del Curry and several other folks from the Hornets on this program on Wednesday, Eric, including CEO Fred Whitfield and COO Pete Gwelly, who told you that hosting this game is a dream fulfilled.
Going way back to when we were the Bobcats, and Fred and I used to dream about opportunities like this. Would we ever want to host an All-Star game? But it was too much work when you look at all the other things we needed to do, the things we had in front of us to improve the franchise and put it in a position to attract marquee events like this. So that was something that wasn't even on our radar. Once we transitioned to the Hornets and the business got to a point where we felt comfortable going after things like this, then the dialogue became real.
Why is this game so important to the team, to the Hornets?
I think because the whole NBA comes to town, and it's really sort of a stamp of approval. Remember, not too long ago, they were losing $25, $30 million a year. They were called the Bobcats, and nobody cared. So they are a much better place now, at least business-wise. They still have work to do on the court. Okay.
A couple more things to talk about with regard to the NBA All-Star Weekend. Then, of course, we have the BB&T SunTrust merger and the quarter-cent sales tax being proposed to support the arts. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Nick Oxner is here from WBTV News. Gwendolyn Glenn is here from WFAE News, as is Alex Olgan. It was a hard slog to get here this morning with the NBA traffic and whatnot, but they walked from their desks.
Right into the studio.
That's right. Eric Spanberg is here, managing editor of the Charlotte
Alex
Business
Alex dodged Journal. Steph Curry on the way into the...
Really?
Yeah.
Say, two members of the Hornets are on the All-Star team this year. Who are they?
So Kimball Walker is a starter in the All-Star game, and then a rookie, Miles Bridges, is part of the dunk contest on Saturday night.
Okay. All-Star game will be played at the Spectrum Center. I think it's Sunday.
Night,
8
o'clock.
Some events will take place at Bojangles Coliseum on Independence. There will be other events all over town, 36 league-sanctioned events with 150 other unofficial parties, receptions, and panel discussions tied to the game this weekend. What will be happening and where, pray tell? Is this kind of like the CIAA and what goes on there?
Yeah, I mean, there are things going on everywhere. For an obvious example would be the Mint Museum is not open for art exhibits because Nike has taken over the museum, and they're showing off the latest shoes, $350 self-tying sneakers.
And a shoe museum, too, right?
Yes, and a shoe museum. And there are things like that going on all over Uptown. These companies come in, and they want to show off their products, and they bring in the players who endorse those products, and it's just a big ecosystem that builds and builds and builds.
Okay. And when we talk about these major sporting events, we always talk about the intangible benefit of having them here in terms of public relations and advertising for the city of Charlotte. 150,000 people will be walking the streets. That's 300,000 eyeballs looking at Charlotte and scrutinizing it. And it's also being broadcast to 215 countries around the world. Does the NBA have beauty shots like the NFL does?
Oh, sure.
Are they going to see Charlotte?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So there's a value.
You'll see the skyline. And TNT, the main network that's covering this weekend's events, they're going to have 24 hours of coverage all told between starting last night. Actually, they were at the Fillmore with their studio show. So, yeah. There will be a lot of Charlotte on TV.
Gwen?
One thing that I was going to say, I've attended All-Star games in other cities when it was in Atlanta, when it was in D.C., and some people are saying that they might be missing some of that potential free advertising because there was not has not been a whole lot. In other places where I've attended, 2 or 3 weeks out, there were events going on every night all over those cities. And I haven't seen that in Charlotte. Like, I think most of them probably just started on Wednesday, the events. But I would say every museum, every restaurant, every, you know, plays were pushed. And that made people come in earlier to these cities where I've attended it before. But I haven't seen that kind of enthusiasm, energy, and events leading up to it weeks out.
Well, Michael Jordan talked about energy at that press conference. We played a clip from him, and you were there at that press conference and got a chance to ask him a couple of questions. He's, as I said, very elusive. He won't come on this program, so what's he like?
I think Michael Jordan is the same as he's ever been, which is when he deigns to speak. He's very personable. He's obviously got a lot of charisma. We saw him on those commercials for years and years because he's good at it. So he is in a position where he just doesn't have to do a lot of these things, so he doesn't.
At that press conference, Jordan praised Hornets CEO Fred Whitfield and the NBA for persisting in getting the league to bring the games to town after they canceled their appearance here in 2017 because of HB2. And yesterday I asked the mayor what the tussle over Charlotte's non-discrimination ordinance and HB2 and all that ensued actually accomplished in the end.
I think it brought attention to the reality of today's and our environment, that if we are going to actually continue to grow and bring the best talent, the creative talent, all of that, we can't spend time talking about bathrooms. We have to spend our efforts on putting forth these positive things that can happen in our city that illustrate that we are accepting and welcoming people and that we want diversity.
So I asked the mayor yesterday, couldn't they have done, let me back up. The NBA has mandated that all restrooms and all all-star facilities, including those at event sites, hotels, and businesses involved with the weekend's all-star activities, be open for use by all individuals consistent with their gender identities. And I asked the mayor yesterday, couldn't that have been done while HB2 was in force and the games could have been played here in 2017?
Yes, it could have been done.
So why didn't they do that?
Well, because remember, let me start with, even though that arena is publicly owned, the Hornets operate it, and so they can do what they want with the restrooms, and they weren't following HB2.
Right.
The rub here is that the NBA was not going to put its showcase weekend in a state or a city where a law like HB2 was in effect. They just simply were not going to do that. And if you follow the NBA, they have tended to be much more progressive than the other sports leagues, certainly the NFL and certainly Major League Baseball. So that's just the way they operate.
And if you recall, the NBA played a role in the negotiations over the repeal of HB2 way back to the first iteration of a proposal long before the bill was actually repealed.
I should mention Fred Whitfield, who is the Hornets CEO. Mm-hmm. He was one of 5 or 6 business leaders that lobbied for a year before that repeal or partial repeal was approved. So, yeah, they were very, very involved. And the other reason, Mike, beyond the All-Star game is, remember, they have to bring in concerts, so they operate the building.
Right.
These bands start canceling events, they're not going to have much of a business. So they were highly concerned about HB2.
So speaking of business, BB&T and SunTrust surprised a lot of people this week when they announced their intention to merge to form the 6th largest bank in the nation and headquarter it here. As a result, no incentives, no tax breaks were dangled in front of them, and they didn't ask. In a world where incentives and tax breaks are the norm, why didn't they ask?
I think this is so interesting for so many reasons. I mean, one of the things that this shows is if a company thinks that the talent is there and it's the right place, they're going to go there.
Well, let's talk about that, because Amazon didn't come here because there wasn't enough tech talent. They're going to put their headquarters here because of the tech talent that's available, the fintech talent that's available to them here in Charlotte. Now, yesterday was announced that Amazon is pulling the plug on their New York headquarters because New York didn't want them. People in Queens didn't want them. Well, they're saying that they're going to take the 25,000 people right. who would have had jobs in Queens and put them in their Crystal City, Virginia location, their other headquarters, and in Nashville. Why not here?
Well, and they're
lobbying
also
for them. Are we going after them?
A lot of those 25,000 jobs are going to existing Amazon hubs all over the country. So they're not, they're not going out for bid again. In other words, they're not going to have that second headquarters of the second headquarters. This is also confusing.
Yeah. So do we know how many jobs the BB&T SunTrust merger will affect? Because when you combine banks, they usually lay people off. And certainly this bank has there are some areas where there are branches of each
Many
bank
areas.
Within a mile of each other.
About a quarter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what will this do?
Well, so it's we don't know is the first answer. Okay. But then the backstory to that is, yes, you'll have these branches that are nearby. Obviously, you'll have a lot of consolidation there. But the headquarters is coming here, and neither one of these companies has obviously had their headquarters here in the past. So you're going to have a lot of jobs created, particularly through this innovation center that is designed at ramping up their mobile banking products. So we don't know. But the net will be a gain in jobs.
But there's a long road for approval, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it should be done by the end of this year, but they do have to go through some hoops.
So I said this merger was announced this week. I was incorrect. It was announced last week. We've just been talking about it all week. That's why I got confused. Charlotte Arts and Science Council made a presentation to Mecklenburg County Commission this week proposing a quarter-cent sales tax for the arts. This has been done before, not for the arts, but we have had a temporary quarter-cent sales tax.
And a revaluation year?
Not on a revaluation year. But what was the commission's reaction to this proposal?
First of all,
roughly that.
Nick enjoyed that so much. It was like you just gave him a Christmas present.
This is what you're missing when you don't watch the Facebook Live, folks.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I don't remember.
I already lost the question.
I don't remember. What was the commission's reaction to this request?
Well, it was, Pat Cotham was skeptical, but others were pretty positive about it, including George Dunlap, who is the chair of the board.
I was going to ask you how much money this is going to raise, but I recall from reading about this that it's going to raise more money than they need.
Yes, so $50 million.
So the carrot and the stick was, we'll take 20, you keep the 30.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Why not make it an 8-cent sales tax?
Well, that's a great question, Mike. I do not know how they settled upon the quarter cent, although that's the max, right?
I think just because you can.
Yeah,
I think that's how they
can.
Settled okay. on that.
So now, the timing, as you mentioned, may not be good. The optics certainly aren't because of uncertainty over property tax and the revaluation. And I think it's Valicia McDowell with the Arts and Council. Arts and Science Council, she's their incoming board chair, told the county that funding for them is at a crisis point.
Where we are today in 2019 in terms of funding to ASC is roughly equivalent to where we were in 1997.
Now, all these nonprofit charities took a hit with the Great Recession, but 1997 was well before the Great Recession. And at the time, wasn't it true that the Charlotte Arts and Science Council was among the most successful arts funding organizations in the country? Mm-hmm. What happened?
I think what happened to them is the same thing that happened to United Way, okay. which is in Charlotte, there was such a strong culture of that annual presentation. They would come to your office mm-hmm. and they would tell all the employees all the wonderful things they did. And the employees would kind of get in line and say, okay, I'm in.
It used to be payroll deduction.
Yes, mm-hmm. payroll deduction. And over time, that has just come almost completely unraveled. I mean, their fundraising is what? It's a fraction of what it used to be. And I think the United Way will tell you the same thing. Those workplace campaigns just don't do what they used to. Now, whether they should have a tax, I think will be a very interesting public debate.
Okay. City Council recently went to Raleigh for their annual retreat. They spent $59,000 in the several days that they were there. County Commission spent 3 days in Greensboro at the Grandover Resort there and spent $26,000. And the school board stayed home recently for their retreat at CPCC and spent $1,200.
Show them what they've won.
I'll take door number two. What were the purposes of these retreats substantially different? Because the price tags were
no. And it's we should first note that it is significant that we already know the cost of this year's city council retreat because it took an entire year for them to release the costs of last year's retreat. Okay. And so I guess kudos to them for finally being transparent.
Well, the mayor, I asked her about this yesterday, and she said that the $59,000 was money well spent.
They did on what?
They went to Raleigh. They stayed in hotels. They ate in restaurants. They had to meet with the legislators and build bridges, and that's worth the money.
They meet with the Charlotte and Mecklenburg County delegation, folks who, by the way, live here, and the governor stops by their dinner at Sullivan's Steakhouse, where they also ate last year, and the governor is in town all weekend for the Charlotte All-Star Game. To me, you can present very little justification as to why you need $50,000. $59,000 of taxpayer money.
Don't get him agitated.
And they added, this year they expanded it an extra day, I believe, or half a day.
New and improved.
There were other government agencies that spent money on retreats, namely Cardinal, that got in a lot of trouble. I'm not saying it's at the same level, but... You know, okay. Fancy retreats.
Do you think it helps the image of Charlotte, you know, the animosity that has existed between Charlotte and Raleigh? Do you think that by them being there and from my understanding mayor had, she got a lot of brownie points and a lot of...
Vial Isles has a lot of brownie points with the legislature. It's not because they drop almost $60,000 in Raleigh. I'll tell you that. And also, this retreat took place at a time when nothing was going on in the General Assembly, so it's not like there was a lot of action buzzing around Raleigh. And you know, there were legislators there, but, you know, it's not like they had to be there to get the
words buzzing and Raleigh don't belong in the same sentence.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, Governor Roy Cooper wants to do something his predecessor, Pat McCrory, refused to do. That's expand Medicaid, Alex. Ours is one of only 14 states that has yet to expand government health benefits for the poor and disabled under the Affordable Care Act. We still have a Republican legislature. Mm-hmm. Is this likely to happen?
There has been some talk about expanding Medicaid for years. The Republicans say they want work requirements. Basically, in order to qualify, you have to prove you have a job, which in reality, most of these people already have a job. The argument is that it's extra paperwork. But of course, it does affect some people. But the hospitals are not happy. They wanted Medicaid expanded for a long time because it would, you know, they serve a lot of Medicaid patients. The way this bill is written, it would be a tax on hospitals.
Governor McCrory told me on this program many times that we couldn't afford to expand Medicaid because the Medicaid system in North Carolina was broken and needed to be fixed first. Has it been fixed, or was that just an excuse not to get on the Obamacare bandwagon?
Well, they're privatizing it, if that's what he considers fixed. I'm not sure. The theory is that it will cost less money. But, I mean, expanding Medicaid is a huge federal match. I think it's 90% they pay. And so, you know, the amount of revenue that's lost out by providers and hospitals and community health centers and things like that, I mean, a lot of people argue that it's worth it.
So very quickly, the legislature has been failing at art class for quite a while as they try to draw legislative maps and congressional maps. They keep being torn up.
Very abstract art.
Thank you very much. Yes. But a bipartisan group of legislators on Wednesday said they want to file a bill to create an 11-member independent body to draw the state's maps. This would be a nonpartisan group of people. What's the likelihood of this happening?
Except that the legislators still have to approve the maps.
Yeah, but it'd be four Republicans and four Democrats.
Nick, tell us, pointillism, yes or no in Raleigh?
Look, the speaker threw cold water on this immediately in an interview after this proposal, and he basically said, who are the nonpartisans? Everyone's a partisan.
Well, that's true anywhere.
Well, that's right, but that's what he said. So that's a sign to me that this isn't going to move.
Okay.
No Surratt for you.
That's right. That's pointillism. Yeah. You know about that, don't you? Yeah. Well, after the NBA game, or before the game is played, between the Daytona 500, which is Sunday at 2, yes, featuring, what's his name? William Bryan, who was at Charlotte Country Day.
Yes.
He's the pole position. Between that and the game, you can enjoy Sunday in the park with George.
Very well done.
Thank you very much. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Nick Oxton from WBTV, Gwendolyn Glenn, and Alex Olgan from WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.